when we talk about addiction also as a symptom of PTSD or early developmental trauma, it's because a lack of nurturing or a stressed nervous system that is steeped in fear will seek relief. And it creates an attraction to addictive activities as a way to numb emotional pain. Children learn to do life alone. They become these pseudo-independent partners later in life. And again, like I said earlier, it's going to be very difficult for them to progress onto the higher developmental stages of relationship growth, which involves mutual interdependence according to this developmental model that we're studying. So they'll keep the partnership stuck in the early regress stages long after they should have moved on. Their capacity for true empathy is limited because their insecurity keeps them primarily focused on themselves and survival. So if you have an insecure attachment, you are really driven by survival. You want that other person to be close to you, not so much because you love them for who they are, it's because you need them so that you won't be full of fear. Does that make sense? So the real motivation is more self than other. And so the idea that you have true empathy is something that will develop over time in couples therapy and will be an important part of helping them build the relationship in their recovery. And the fantasy is that their partner will fulfill their unmet emotional needs, yet at the same time they can't allow themselves to be vulnerable enough to open up to receive it. Feels too dangerous, too risky. They may have learned that people are dangerous if there's been a lot of early trauma, right? So how do I do that? So it's a real double bind for them. And for you as the therapist, you can see how difficult your work is. It was important to know that they don't hold themselves accountable to be the agents of change for their own emotional lives and growth. They tend to look to the other to do it to them or for them. So it makes for a lot of high reactivity in their adult relationships, which can look like the fight response, so they're fighting a lot, or like the hostile dependent, or it can be that flight response, like Sarah was talking about this morning, this conflict avoidance, this soon as something flares up, I'm out of here. So there's never a way to work through anything difficult in the relationship. I heard a neuroscientist recently say on the radio that the brain is as complex as the universe itself, which really made me feel better because it's so hard to understand this stuff sometimes and we only just know a bit. He also said that neuroscience is really in its infancy. But from what we know to date is that it appears that circuitry in the limbic or reptilian parts of the brain do not function normally, and so addicts are literally wired for addiction.
Sorry, say that again. So if there's addiction, the circuitry is not
right, wired,
or the circuitry is wired incorrectly initially, and then therefore they're more sensitive to addiction.
Both.
So it changes it, and it could be like that.
Right. There is a hypersensitivity to addictive cues that cause the floodgates of dopamine to open, and through adaptation in the brain, it's called neuroadaptation, addiction becomes reinforced. For some addicts who struggle with chronic relapse after some abstinence, research has shown that there are also deficits in the prefrontal cortex, such that when presented with cues, so these are people that have been sober for a while, and then they go to a bar, let's say, or they, meet up with a friend who's still using, you know, the drug of their choice and invites them, says, hey, you want to come get high? And they are unable to override with their thinking the impulses for destructive addictive behavior. And all of this can be further compromised if there was trauma involved in their lives. So we see that there, you know, it's really multifaceted. It can be from birth, it can be then compromised from trauma or compromised from use. So you put that substance in, the brain starts to adjust itself, it shuts down receptors, and then everything gets up, or it makes more receptors, it starts to do all kinds. The body is an amazing mechanism, and it will continually try to adjust and adapt for homeostasis. What do I need to do to get this back to balance? And it starts to change. But some of that just reinforces the addiction. And it's harder to get, you know, you build up tolerance. You don't get the same high as you used to from the same thing. So you need more. And all of these things then reinforce addiction. I had a client tell me that in a fit of anger because he was being confronted about a relapse that he did and that it was serious and he was trying to minimize it, go out and make a very large purchase. He bought an item of clothing that was $10,000 and he did it to prove to everybody how successful he was. And what I said to him was, I rest my case with you. That is total insanity. And, you know, there, it's like when you're talking about what are you dealing with emotionally with addicts, there is a real, you know, there's something that's not really functioning at a level that makes any sense at all. And when they talk about the insanity of alcoholism, they are not talking about schizophrenia. They're talking about the way the mind of an alcoholic or addict works and that it tells itself lies all the time and believes them as truth. So there's a real delusional quality to the way they function in the world. Well, I'll just buy this $10,000 jacket and I'll prove to them that it's not that big a deal, as if those two things are related. But in his mind, the fact that he's successful financially means that he can't be that bad. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so he doesn't, he's not able to connect the dots, and then he's going to use his rage and he's going to throw his money out at the world to try to prove that he's right and he won't hear otherwise. My prefrontal cortex still loves you, but my amygdala just booked a one-way ticket to Fiji. So that's what we're talking about. In the prefrontal cortex is where the relational circuitry is. It's where you want your clients to be when you're working with them. You do not want them to be so distressed and activated that their amygdalas are running the show, because they're going to go into fight or flight. So the idea that you're teaching people how to calm themselves, that you're ensuring that, you know, sessions slow down enough if people are really activated. Why? Because of this. And you want to be able to help them understand this. Nothing good is going to happen if the amygdala is running the show. They're taking a one-way trip somewhere, and it's not towards the other person, okay? As I mentioned, there's always trauma behind self-destructive behavior. Addicts are self-medicating. They lack the emotional strength to deal with the everyday trials and tribulations of life. And they have a lot of internalized anger that is often turned on the self. When a couple shows up for therapy, it'll be very different depending on whether there is still active addiction, white-knuckle sobriety, or early recovery, or stable recovery. It's going to be very different. I had a couple recently, and they've been in recovery for 17 years, both of them. And while there were some pretty serious issues going on, they were able to really come around quickly. And because they have this foundation of 12-step recovery to lean on, that's always been my experience, is that that has just facilitated the change process in therapy. So addiction from a trauma perspective can be seen as a survival strategy. Any perceived threat will trigger the automatic responses in the survival brain, and they will drink to protect themselves, or drug, or look at porn, or do whatever it is they do, shop, whatever, to make themselves feel good for the effect it produces. That is why the addict is angry and defensive, goes into fight when challenged to give up their drug of choice before they are ready to let it go. If they keep that anger inside, they will leave therapy prematurely. So if, in other words, if you're not addressing it, and I do this a lot because, and I have sometimes people leave because they do not want to give up their drinking, let's say, we'll use that as an example. nice couple, middle-aged, you know, kids. You know, their relationship is really going off the rails. They're going further and further away from each other. They come into therapy. It's great. Yes, let's do it. Turns out it starts to come up in conversation. There's no red flags for me initially, but all of a sudden we're starting to talk about, oh, I was drunk when I said that. I didn't mean it. And I'm asking them, how much are you drinking? And it turns out they're drinking most days. So I say to them, well, look, I don't know if you guys have a problem or not, or if you're just using it to get through this tough time, but here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to suggest that you both stop drinking while we're working on therapy. And I'll explain to them if when you start drinking or when you use alcohol, you don't grow emotionally. Because the hard work of facing yourself and learning how to tolerate your uncomfortable feelings, learning how to express them in a close personal relationship, is all part of you growing and maturing and developing more intimacy in your relationship. And if you're taking a drink and saying, oh, well, it doesn't matter so much, or, you know, I'll deal with that tomorrow, or whatever it is you do when you have that drink or two, you're not growing. Would you be able to do that? Would you be able to stop for, let's say, the next 3 months while we work intensely on the couple's, the relationship issue? Sure, no problem. So they stop for a couple of weeks, a month, and then they go on vacation. Well, we're on vacation. We have to drink. So then they come back and they say, well, we drank on vacation. Okay, well, can we get back on track then? Now that you drank on vacation, can we go back to what we were doing and keep working? And then the next thing you know, they're not coming anymore. So what happened? Right? What happened? And here's the thing I always say to people, and you know, for me it is really quintessential. I say to them, look, here's the deal, and I give them the explanation just like I gave to you. If you're using substances or you're using addictive behaviors as a way to opt out of feeling what you're feeling, you are undermining the work we're trying to do here. So please, do not leave here and say couples therapy doesn't work. I do not want that on my shoulders. I am telling you that if we are going to have the outcome that you are here saying you want, is to have more of a loving connection, more peace and harmony, to be your highest self, to be the best partner you can be. We can do that together, but not if you're undermining it with ongoing alcohol and drug use. If you choose not to stop and the therapy doesn't work, it will be because of that. Okay? So I want to put it out there really clearly. I don't want it on my shoulders. I don't want to be working at cross purposes with something as powerful as an addictive substance or behavior. It will always win because of the reward pathway. What we're asking them to do is to use a different reward system. There are two reward systems in the brain. One is this kind of, you know, quick and fast and furious, and the other one is based in satisfaction.
Can I just go back? We were talking about that sort of trauma, but some people don't necessarily have trauma. Their brain's kind of wired for, they may not be bringing, they may not have a trauma background, even a developmental trauma background. So will those folks show up as wanting to be so fight-oriented, or are you saying that the addiction plus the trauma will kind of more often create that profile?
I have seen very few people who are steeped in addiction who don't have some trauma.
Yeah,
that's basically my premise, is that it's an intimacy disorder, and these are people that can't connect. And so how does that overlay with the predisposition, the brain that's vulnerable? Well, we know there's some genetic factors. You know, we know that there's all kinds of ways. It's so, like I say, the brain is so complex that no two people are exactly alike. And yet my experience has been, and what most of the researchers are saying in the field, is that there's always trauma.
Yeah.
And actually, you can understand, Deutsch says in The Brain That Changes Itself, he says that with sex addicts, you can almost predict what their trauma was by what they're doing, with their behavior. So there's usually trauma there. For example, had a mother who was kind of abusive, but also sexually inappropriate with her son. Walked around with negligees, talked about sex, but was quite mean. Picks women who want to do S&M with him and treat him really badly. And
sexy and nasty.
Sexy and nasty, exactly. So that would be an example. And addicts have been recognized to have four main cognitive distortions that include black and white thinking, intense self-loathing, overly negative view of life, and catastrophizing. And you can see it in her as well. So often you'll see it in the spouses as well, especially if they grew up with alcoholism, because then you have all the isms, all the other parts of the family dynamics that's not about the drinking or the drugging. But it's more about secrecy, not talking about feelings, and you know, not knowing how to be open and honest, and all of that kind of stuff that just isn't there in a family system that's steeped in addiction. Or, and again, religious fanaticism is another form of addiction.